Welcome to Present Company, the Netflix podcast that brings you dynamic conversations with exceptional people behind your favorite series, films, documentaries, and specials. I'm your host, Krista Smith. For years, I was Vanity Fair's ambassador to Hollywood, interviewing countless actors as well as creatives and authorities across the spectrum. My passion is talent, any form of it. How do you know you have it? How do you cultivate it? How do you protect it? And also, I want to get to the heart of what drives it. On this podcast, I'll be talking to people in Hollywood and far beyond. Thank you for joining me. Welcome back to the show. Today, I have a very special episode for you. Academy Award winner Gary Oldman joins me to discuss his extraordinary performance in David Fincher's latest film, Mank. Oldman plays Herman J. Mankiewicz, a.k.a. Mank, the celebrated screenwriter with a razor-sharp wit who co-wrote Citizen Kane with Orson Welles.
The narrative is one big circle like a cinnamon roll, not a straight line pointing to the nearest exit. You cannot capture a man's entire life in 2 hours. All you can hope is to leave the impression of one.
But nobody expects Shakespeare. People aren't spending their hard-earned 25 cents to see Macbeth.
Maestro, the dark-faced boy, did Macbeth.
Voodoo, Macbeth. Don't be fooled. He's a showman, busker, reveling in sleight of hand. Save yourself the trouble. Be done in 60 days.
He'll get this, and the audience will, too. Stop worrying. Have a pickle.
No, thank you. I'm not hungry. Haven't been since we got here. Cheerio. Write hard. Aim low.
On a personal note, I have to say this film's depiction of the golden age of Hollywood, the creative process, power, friendships, personal demons, all of it, it's just exquisite. Gary talks about why he wanted to be a part of this film, how his own experience with alcoholism informed his performance, why he felt daunted by Fincher's directive not to transform physically for the role, and why he has so much admiration for the way Fincher approaches the work. We also talk about the arc of his own career and one of his most memorable performances. Plus, he shares his advice for young actors just starting out. So I wanted to go back to when you first heard about this movie and, you know, how this movie first came to you and what your reaction was when that script, when you opened that script and read it.
Initially, I was just, obviously I was very excited before I'd read the script because it ticked a box of mine. I've worked with some wonderful directors over the years and David was certainly, you know, on that list. So that was very exciting that it was a Fincher movie. And then to just read this glorious writing by his dad, Jack Fincher. I mean, if I had any reservations, you know, you think, oh, it's a story about a writer in Hollywood, and is it too a little bit sort of in baseball, as they say? Not only that, he's lying down, so he's in bed for most of it. I thought, how exciting could I make that? But it was one of the best scripts I had read in a long time, and I was just thrilled to be asked to do it. I was very thrilled, very honored. Mm.
I mean, obviously, Herman Mankiewicz is a brilliant man who is deeply, you know, had a lot of turmoil. was he someone that, did you know about him before you had read the script? Were you aware of this character of Mank? Because he was a real person.
Yeah. I was more aware of Joseph, the brother, just because of his achievements. I mean, in my mind, you know, in many people's opinion, you know, that All About Eve is one of the great all-time screenplays and films. Mm-hmm. And he had a huge career. So I was more aware of Joseph than I was of Herman Mankiewicz, and vaguely knew that you know, there was that connection with Wells, and that he had done a bit of sort of script doctoring and a bit of writing for the Marx Brothers. But it was a whole, basically, it was a blank canvas to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've said, and I love this, so I hope it's true. You've talked about how acting isn't necessarily an intellectual pursuit, but it's more of a sensation and a feeling. And I wonder, what was that for you with this character, with Mank? What was that sensation that got you to this character, that doorway?
You know, the process is—it's all still a bit of a mystery. There's a certain, obviously, there's a certain amount of work, of head work that you need to do with a character like this, because there's quite a bit of information out there on him, and there's no footage of him. Tiny, tiny little cameo he did in an early movie, which doesn't really tell you very much. And it's all anecdotal. You know, he said this, he said that, he did this, he did that. So there's that work that you gather the information as much as you can. But I've also said that you could do, you know, if you were playing Hamlet, you could read every book there is on Hamlet. You could holiday in Denmark and whatever, you know, whatever kind of work you would do in that respect, or research, I guess, as it's called. But I've always said you can do all of that, but on opening night, that won't help you stand there and say to be or not to be. Now, I've had my, you know, Mank was an alcoholic, and I've been in recovery now for almost 24 years. But I do remember what it was like. So in that respect, I could bring a lot to the party, because you have to sort of get inside not only a brilliant mind, but a drunk mind. And that, to me, was very obvious from what I was sort of researching or looking at. You see it in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He turns on everyone who wants to help him. You know, drunks want an enemy. They need a villain. He really had some villains there. So there's a lot of your own. It's a lot of my own experience, really, that I gave. That I brought with me. Here's the other interesting thing. You know, you take a role like Churchill, and there's, you know, he wrote 50-something books. There's hundreds of books written about the man. Every moment of his waking life is documented. And you have footage, you have speeches, you have all of this thing to gravitate to. And also the physicality, you know, that I don't really think I could have been a convincing Churchill without the prosthetics, but you have that also you have. You have a mask. You have all this voluminous material, and you have a mask. David did not want any trick. He didn't want anything. He didn't want a wig. He didn't want a false nose. He didn't want false teeth. He said to me, I want you to be as naked as you have ever, ever been. And I do like, you know, I like a nose or a pair of glasses to hide behind. give me a, I don't know, a glass eye or a scar or something, or a patch. A wig, you know. It just seems that that's happened to me over the years. You know, with these various characters I played. So that was incredibly challenging, and very daunting, and I resisted it at first. And it wasn't until I started a kind of move and breathe in the language and in the script and in the clothes and the shoes that I realized. I thought, you know, Dave was right. This is good. No fireworks, no fancy dress. Just come in and be as completely open and as naked as you can be. I haven't really answered your question about how do you get into it.
Well, specifically, I wanted to know what that moment was when you've got, oh, I've got Mank. This is it. This is the essence of him. So you.
Well, I think that started. It varies. Sometimes it can be a certain physicality. It can be a gesture. It could be a way a character moves, walks, hunches their shoulders. I mean, there's all sorts of little keys that unlock a door for you to get into a character. With this one, it was a vocal thing, I think, with this one that really got the ball rolling was finding the voice. Now, there's no recording of Mank, but there's plenty of recordings of Joe Mankiewicz. And I thought to myself, you know, the apple probably doesn't fall far from the tree. So that was what I started to work on, that real dry delivery, that sort of throwaway delivery with the voice of Joseph Mankiewicz. And that's kind of where I started. That's not necessarily where I ended up, but you begin with an impersonation and then you own it and you start to make it your own thing. And so you've got that, you know, you've got the basic root sound and timbre from Joe, and then you add a bit of smoking and some whiskey, or a lot of whiskey on top of that voice, and you give it a pinch of Burgess Meredith, and you have Mank. I hope.
Definitely you have Mank. And in Mank, it's just, he's so funny and he's so alive. That Gary, you made him so alive in a bed with a body cast, essentially. You know, that's what I thought was so incredible. Yes, with the flashbacks, we see you obviously, but there's a big portion of it when you are, like you had said earlier, just flat out and in a cast and limited physically as an actor.
Well, it was interesting. I've played my share of sort of rather energetic, you know, frenetic characters. So that in itself was it was challenging, and it was actually a relief. I'd get out of bed, come into work, and get back into bed. It was, in that respect, it was quite a sweet gig. actually, going back to your other question about the finding a character, apart from all of that stuff I talked about, you know, moving of the voice, and which again goes back to that thing of you feel it. It's a sensation. It is the muscles in the mouth. It's the tongue and the teeth, and all of that is vital. But I also have his writing. It's what he wrote, and that also gives you a wonderful clue into the character.
He's so funny. Oh my God!
And we know what others thought of him as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Orson Welles described him, who loved him dearly, loved Mank dearly, said that he was the perfect monument to self-destruction. He embodied the very essence of it and was very bitter and of course, incredibly funny and well said, that when that bitterness, or that vile bile wasn't aimed at you, he said he was the funniest man on the earth. Now, some people have said, going back to the old days around the, you know, the Algonquin table in the early days, that even when that bile was aimed at you, he was so funny that you would laugh in spite of yourself.
I have no trouble believing that.
and of course, it's peppered with, what we try to do in that regard, because there's wonderful quotes. You can go, you can Google, Herman Mankiewicz quotes. What we try to do, which is where Jack and then David was clever, is not to make it all about, the greatest hits, and you just overload the script with all the funny lines.
Mm-hmm.
So we use them sparingly, but when we use them, and there's a wonderful line that Jack came up with, or maybe it was even David in a rewrite. When I arrive at San Simeon on the day when I wake up and I'm hungover, and there is Mayor and Irving watching this sort of crazy shoot of a home movie going on with Hurst and Marion, and I say, "Oh, I'm on my way over there. Any notes from the oversight tent?" I mean, as long as you can walk and chew gum at the same time. I mean, it's hard. It would be very hard to mess that one up. So I had some glorious lines in this film, and I relished and enjoyed saying them.
Well, I, as a viewer, enjoyed watching. It was just delicious, and you really pay attention to them, and then you think about, and it makes them even funnier. One of the things I found very interesting in this story, which I find parallels many, many lives, and certainly those in the creative sphere, is that conflict between the person we want to be and the person we end up being to kind of make a living in the world or exist in the world. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that?
Well, he looked down on screenwriting. I think he sort of felt that it was beneath him. It was beneath his talent. I think he had aspirations of being a great playwright, a great novelist. And that's what sort of separated the men from the boys. That was true writing, great literature. And writing for the movies was, he had such a disdain for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we look back on it now. Of course, he didn't realize at the time of what a seismic shift he had in movie making. Now, you don't necessarily, when you're in the moment of doing it, you don't realize that you're turning the evolutionary wheel a notch. And he did. He invited so many wonderful writers to Hollywood who really, I wouldn't say necessarily changed the genre. They came up with a genre. That sort of witty, fast-paced, New York kind of wisecracking banter really, you know, he was responsible for that. And also, when you're a script doctor, which he kind of basically was, you know, you're going to hand in your script. I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to pour your life into a script that is then going to be rewritten and then rewritten and then rewritten and then changed? And at the end of the day, you don't even have your name on it.
Mm. For our listeners, Gary, I'm going to explain what a script doctor is. It's basically a writer who gets a script and is instructed to make it better or add some jokes or improve upon it. And to your point, oftentimes it goes to many, many different writers. And in the end, it ends up being whoever's name was originally on it gets the credit.
Yeah. So, you know, a script would be, you know, a script, it would have problems. And, you know, an executive would say, well, let's run it through Manx typewriter and see what you can come up with. I mean, you know, do you know the story about, I mean, it's touched on in the film in passing, but you know the story about the Wizard of Oz and his involvement with that film.
Why don't you tell us?
Well, it was Mac who the whole Kansas sequence. The writer of the book now, whose name escapes me, it gives a couple of thousand words to Kansas. And Mank, in that first draft, wanted to root Dorothy and those people in a reality so that when you went to the fantastical, you kind of earned it, because the film is going one way and then it sort of whips the carpet out from underneath your feet and surprises you. And I remember, everybody remembers, and I remember as a kid watching the film and that moment where Dorothy steps into Technicolor. It takes your breath away. You're there, you're in Kansas, you're with Dorothy, she's got a little dog, there are the characters that appear, she sings this fantastic song, and you think you're in one movie. And then it takes you into this Technicolor fantasy. Mank felt that you really had to earn it. And you had to establish the characters to really be then to be able to follow them in the narrative. He also came up with the idea that that whole first sequence should be shot in black and white, and to capture the writing of the book, the spirit of the book, that she then, when she goes to Oz, it all turns into Technicolor.
Mm.
Part of him thought it was just all a piece of crap. You know, but, and then he was ultimately fired from the project, and he just moved on. As he said as I say in the film, oh, that thing's going to sink the studio, you know. You know, much like that, much like the guy that turned down the Beatles or the Rolling Stones. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But that thing's not going. They're not going anywhere. Well, I don't know what exactly he was paid, but those ideas are worth their weight in gold. That's the genius of Mank.
Yeah, it's a great, that great scene actually that David does alludes to that in the big third act scene with the confrontation with Orson. In the middle of that scene, Meg is like, oh, that would be a great ending. You know, he's always thinking about the story.
And that's why he has that. I mean, he adores Marion, but he knows he's onto something. and he can't separate. He can't take that writer's hat off. And he says to her, I'm going to have to follow this and go through with it. I cannot put this down or walk away from it. It's too good. It's the best thing I've ever done. And if it's made, you're either going to be my friend or you're not going to be my friend. And my friendship means, your friendship means a great deal to me. But I'm a writer and I'm working on something really special. And he can't take that hat off. You know, it's very selfish. But then it is. Art is very, you have to be incredibly selfish. It demands a great deal of you. And I think, I think that's why some of these sort of marriages and relationships don't work, where you've got two people who are working in the industry. You know, you're married to one, but you always have the calling. There's always that mistress. The art is the real marriage. You know.
Right. No.
Certainly it has been for me, and you just age, you just get wiser, hopefully, and you realize where the important things in life. You just get older, you have children, all of those things, and then you realize where your priorities are. But it demands so much of your energy, emotional energy. And look what look how, you know, the relationship with Sarah, who he adored her, but he, you know, and he's, and, you know, and you're an addict, so you drink and you gamble, and now the alcoholism didn't manifest itself in Joe Mankiewicz, but then he had a big gambling problem, and he sought out. He went to therapy, and got his act together. You know, also the film, the period falls between really the sort of putting together Alcoholics Anonymous, which I think started around, I think it was like 1935, 36. I mean, there'd always been temperance societies and things like that way, way back, and the evils of, you know, alcohol. But Alcoholics Anonymous was really started in the mid 30s and didn't become a fellowship as such until the like 1946, 47. And anyone, so this time period, this movie, and the height of Manx drinking, falls right in the middle of that. And to, you know, AA was for people who were on the street drinking paraffin. You know, that was. Now we're so much more aware of the evils of addiction, but I think back then, and wasn't it acceptable? I mean, you would go to lunch with someone, and you'd probably have a couple of bottles of wine, or,
well, it's just, you know, a different. There was less to do. It was a lot of stress and war. You know, a lot of other things that people were living with. But
it was commonplace to have a cocktail cabinet in the office. And someone would come, and a client would come, and you would offer them a scotch or a gin. Then you would go and have a long sort of boozy lunch. But it all comes around again to this thing of, you know, self-loathing. And it feeds the beast. It awakens that the monkey on the back. That is, I'm not really getting on. I should have done something by now. How old am I? I should have written that novel. I should be a famous playwright by now. I'm writing this rubbish. I go in, I work with idiots who don't know what they're talking. I mean, it all, I think it just all, it all piles on. And the only way to really kind of medicate from all of that was
the booze.
Was the booze.
Well, I think what's also very interesting about your career, and I'm going to transition a little bit here, because it is kind of staggering when I went back. There's so many performances, and I can get a little to that a little bit later. But the directors you've worked with, from Christopher Nolan to Francis Ford Coppola, Soderbergh, Cuarón, Oliver Stone, Tony Scott, Joe Wright, I mean, so many of them. And earlier you mentioned wanting to work with David Fincher. And I want you to talk about that a little bit. Like, what are the characteristics that make it a Fincher film? What's the experience with David Fincher?
Well, you know, from the very get-go, there's a vision. There's a very specific vision, an idea behind the film. So it's, in that respect, it's like riding in a Rolls Royce or sitting in first class, and you've got a captain up there in the cockpit who's, just flown thousands and thousands and thousands of hours. You sit back and relax and think, well, you know what, this guy knows what he's doing. I tell you what did surprise me. Because David, as we know, is such a visualist. You know, there's such a vision in terms of the look of a movie, and especially with this, the framing. You know, the composition of the shots, the lighting, and of course this incredible soundscape that he's put together. He knew about that. Going in, this wasn't something he then stumbled upon halfway through the film. I mean, he knew exactly how he wanted it to look and sound from the starting pistol. But so you know you're in good hands in that respect, because you've seen the other work and you think, hey, those movies are great and they look terrific. So you don't have any worries or doubts that he's going to capture the period. Now, with other directors, not necessarily directors I work with, but there are some people where you go, you read the script and you go, my God, this is so delicious. I hope they can fulfill the promise. I hope how I see it and how it plays, how it feels coming off the page, I hope that they can take this and visualize it and put it on the screen, and I won't be disappointed. With David, this era, this honorarium to the golden age and Hollywood and these characters, and you see the streets and Sunset Boulevard, and you see, the Paramount Studios. I mean, you can just imagine. I could imagine. David is going to really nail the period and do something extraordinary with it. But the thing that surprised me was the work that we did on the text in rehearsal. Analyzing every scene, sometimes going over just a word, we need to change that. That needs a little bit more sizzle. What's a good phrase? What's a good word? That doesn't feel right. What's the motivation here? What does Mank want from the scene? What does Marion want from him here? What's his relationship with in this moment here, how does he feel about Hearst? I mean, we did a sort of deep dive into the text. And that's not to say that the dialogue or texts in the other films were lacking. I mean, I think, Zodiac is one of my favorite Fincher films. And I mean, the writing in it is just superb. But he's just the work on the character, characterization, and what we're saying, and does the story make sense, and does that, yeah, is that clear? Will, you know, he's always, he's objective. He's out there sitting in the audience saying, yeah, but would I get that? Would I understand that? Do I follow that argument? So that was sort of surprising to me.
I had talked to Tom Pelfrey earlier, and he just talked about how much he loved being able to do scene after scene, you know, take after take after take, because Fincher obviously is a perfectionist and, like you said, likes to get it right, and how for him that was just brought him so much joy to work in that way. And I thought about those scenes with the two of you and what that meant. And, you know, Fincher is Fincher. I mean, there's a reason why he goes by one name, like Coppola, like Soderbergh. Yeah. People immediately identify with that.
Yeah.
They know.
Well, yeah. And the other thing regarding the takes, he will not do like takes. Unnecessarily just doing take after take after take after take for the sake of it. You know, sometimes we walked away from things and he said, I've got it. I don't really need to keep going on this. Here's the wonderful thing about having the opportunity to do many takes is you really start to live in the word. Well, let's put it this way. I've always thought it was crazy that production would spend millions and millions of dollars on an elaborate set, spend millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars on costume. Mm. And then we would get there in front of the camera and we'd have two or three takes and then we'd move on. I've been in many situations like that, and it puzzles me. Now, I understand that there are budgetary reasons why you can't just do endless takes, but when you look around you sometimes at these sets and these costumes and you think, my word, look at the props, look at the clothes, look at, God, this is marvelous. And then you get two bites of the apple and you're moving on. And I remember, you know, back in the day where you would, you know, a director might do 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 takes. And it's just got progressively worse where it's... I feel sometimes like we're making the day and not making the movie. You don't feel that with David at all.
Well, everybody loves to talk about their favorite Gary Oldman characters and scenes. And I'm sure this must happen to you anytime you leave the house on a regular basis. I have my own, of course, you know, just brilliant performances. I mean, I think I'm partial recently, obviously, to Mank. We're talking about that. But prior to that, I'd say Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Smiley was unbelievable, and maybe in part because my father drove a Citroën, and just seeing that you become that character. And I have vague memories of this character as a kid, you know, being very famous detective spy in the circus and all that. But I love that. JFK, perfection, True Romance, perfection, Sid and Nancy, Dracula, the list goes on and on. And of course, Darkest Hour, which you won the Oscar for. Is there a particular character that you look back on with relish and was like, God, that was fun? I can look back now with maturity and say, that was a great performance and I loved it, and look at that.
Well, Churchill was a wonderful experience, and I don't say that just because it all ended in a gold statue. Just the people, meeting the people, and the the Churchill family, and just really digging in and reading and watching all the footage and visiting, you know, wonderful, having sort of private behind the velvet rope tours of all these wonderful places and the war rooms. And I mean, it was just the journey of Churchill was very special. And I feel deeply honored, very, very privileged to have been able to have done it. Funny enough, a character that I love was in a little movie I did called Nobody's Baby. And it was a sort of a comedic role. I have a great memory of that. And the contender, Shelley Runyon. And that was a wonderful, again, it was a wonderful summer, and we were in Richmond, and just good memories. I'm hypercritical of the work. I do look at the work, I'd look at the work differently from other people. And you mentioned some good ones there. There's probably a few I would stomp on, you know, and or would like to maybe go back and reshoot. But I think that's just because I think a lot of people feel that, whether they sculpt or paint or write songs, or I think sometimes they just look back and they think it's old work, you know, and that's where I was at then. And Alfonso Cuarón, of course, was, you know, it was a wonderful experience working with him. I enjoyed that enormously. See, it's not so much the finished result. Yes, I had a great time working on Mank, and we see the final finished version, and I'm very, very proud to be connected to it and to have been a part of it. But I look back at my career sometimes, and it's just about the real, it's about the experience. Having the experience of coming to work every day and working with some of these incredible people that I work with. That's what I take away. I mean, for Mank, for instance. What a bunch of talented, lovely people. Alice Howard, what a guy, what a gentleman. Tom Pelfrey, adored him. So he was just great in the role, wonderful guy. Amanda is just a sweetheart, doing those scenes with Lily. I think she's the revelation in the film. What a lovely person she is. So you're coming in, working with these people, not only in these great scenes. I have to pinch myself sometimes. You know, there I am in a David Fincher movie playing Mank, and then I get to come in and be surrounded by all these wonderful people, Charles Dance and Tom Burke, who plays Orson, you know. They're... You know, and if that wasn't enough, you have Eric Messerschmidt, the director of photography, who is just a darling of a man. I mean, you have Fincher at the helm.
So good.
Yeah.
I have one more question for you, because and I always end my interviews with this question, and it may look on the outset like Gary Oldman has had this charmed career as an actor, but we know you didn't have anything handed to you. You really had to pursue this on your own. You didn't get into RADA. You did get into another school. You really built this block, this career, brick by brick. You started in the theater. You were relentless in your pursuit. What advice do you have for young people who are just starting out in terms of navigating this business on where to focus their energies, what advice would you have for them?
Well, when things have changed quite dramatically from when I started. So there were opportunities for me that are now, that are not afforded to people who are in, you know, 2020. You know, my training was really geared towards theatre, you know, and I went to a, you know, a drama academy for 3 years rather than just sort of popping in and out of acting classes. But what I would say is no lazy brain, curious, just, and you can't do it, you can't be sort of interested in it or have a passing interest in it. It has to be everything. It's the air that you breathe. It's the first thing you think about when you wake up in the morning, and it's the last thing you think about when you go to bed. No shortcuts. There's no shortcuts. You've got to put the work in. And, you know, and I knew that there were shortcomings, and I had to work on them. And I had to work really hard. You know, I stumbled on an interview with Paul Newman, and he really had to work at it rather than it be a thing that was sort of intuitive. And he would look around him and he'd think, God, these people that could just sort of get up and do it. It seems so easy for them. And he felt that he really did not have that, and that it made him, he had to work twice as hard to sort of get there. That it was always a little bit too heady for him. It was always in the head. And he found it very hard to connect, to find the emotion. Where some people, it was like turning on a faucet. They just had it. But really what he was saying was, I had shortcomings. I recognized them. And I had to really work. I had to work harder than those people who had it intuitively. And there's no substitute for it. That's what I would say, that you must want it more than you want anything else. And also, you've got to remain hopeful and optimistic. You can't think that you're going to, you know, you'll go to drama school or go to, I don't know, Juilliard, and then you're going to come out and work in Walmart. Now, you may for a while end up working in Walmart or driving a cab or waitressing or whatever you end up doing. But you can't. You've got to have the attitude, you know, what do you want to do when you leave Juilliard? I want to be in a great play on Broadway. I want to work with the best people. So you've got to keep, you have to keep optimistic and grow a thick skin.
Great advice for life in general.
I think, yes, you've got to grow a thick skin and remain optimistic.
I would say. Gary, this has been an absolute pleasure. I wish we could just carry on the conversation for the better part of the afternoon. But thank you so much for your time and your incredible performances in all the films and most recently in Mank. It's just a pure delight. So thank you very much.
Well, it's lovely speaking with you, and I'm thrilled that you like it. We're all very proud of it. And so your kind words are deeply felt. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining me. Mank is streaming now on Netflix. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you've been listening. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Krista Smith. Join me next time for more meaningful conversations here at Present Company.